Welcome to NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and cultural stories. I am Netta Ulibi. As a reminder, you can, as always, subscribe to NPR's arts channel at npr.org/culturetopia. This week, we look at the impact of the Vietnam War through the popular music it inspired. Writer and filmmaker Nora Ephron talks about her new book, I Remember Nothing. And for our ongoing series, 50 Great Voices, a profile of the iconic Costa Rican-born singer, Chavela Vargas. But first...
For the first time, a major museum in the United States is dedicating an exhibition to gay and lesbian portraiture. The show, titled Hide/Seek, has opened at the National Portrait Gallery in Washington, D.C. NPR's Netta Ulibi paid a visit.
Hide-seek is not exactly hidden, but to find it, you've got to thread your way upstairs and through massive crowds visiting a nearby Norman Rockwell exhibition. But Gary Fisher came to see just this show. He's an artist in D.C.
To see artwork all by gay men and women in this country exhibited in a place like this is just absolutely amazing. It's about time.
The artists are actually not all gay, but the subjects mostly are. Jonathan Katz is a queer studies scholar who co-curated the exhibition. He cannot overstate the significance of the Smithsonian Institution's involvement.
For a gay man of my generation to understand the federal government as a helpmate was, shall we say, a new feeling.
Katz came of age as an art historian in 1989 when the Corcoran Gallery of Art canceled a retrospective of Robert Mapplethorpe's photographs. Their confrontational gay and S&M content stirred a furor in Congress. Since then, Katz says major museums have basically blacklisted exhibitions focusing on gay sexuality. This one was co-curated by David C. Ward of the Portrait Gallery.
You know, we kind of jumped into this without really knowing what we were doing. It was a little like internet dating. You don't know if you really want to trust the picture.
Backstory. Ward curated a National Portrait Gallery exhibition about the Civil War that included a photograph of Walt Whitman and a male lover. They were identified as such on the title card. When Jonathan Katz visited the exhibition, he was amazed Ward did not get into any trouble for it. They eventually became friends, and their co-curated show has so far gotten great reviews. Ward credits that to their differences.
Jonathan is gay, I'm straight. Jonathan is the outside guy, I'm the inside guy. Jonathan is the academic, I'm a little bit more the bureaucrat.
Ward says Hide Seek is one of the biggest and most expensive shows the National Portrait Gallery has ever launched, with over 100 works of art and music.
When I last night had a great big fight, everything seems to go around.
Even this is portraiture, says scholar Jonathan Katz, a tune by blues singer Ma Rainey that refers to her arrest in 1925 for throwing a lesbian party.
And then she goes on to say, yes, it's true I wear a collar and a tie. Yes, it's true I don't like men. In other words, she's teasing us with the revelation of her lesbian identity.
The show's title, Hide Seek, refers to the artist's quest to represent desires that for years lay beyond social norms. They worked in code or used the cover of a clueless culture. The show includes an ad for shirts from 1914 that pictures a pair of handsome bachelors enjoying domestic bliss. The illustrator used his boyfriend for one of the models. Hide-seek is intentionally complicated, with work by straight artists that nonetheless reveal an appreciation of same-sex erotics. No one could claim Andrew Wyeth was gay. He's famous for his autumn-colored portraits of his lover Helga, but this show includes his portrait of a blonde, nude man. Helga is Beefcake. Curator David C. Ward.
Wyeth said that when you paint somebody's portrait, you fall a little bit in love with them.
Hide Seek includes a lot of works that might be tough to call portraits at first. Two abstract paintings by Jasper Johns and Robert Rauschenberg are hung close together. They're both big, gray, and somber. Johns and Rauschenberg were boyfriends for 6 years. These paintings were finished during their breakup. Jasper Johns, known for his iconic flag images, covered this one under a wash of dark paint.
That's where the stars would have been, in an American flag. And the stars have gone out. His relationship with Rauschenberg is over.
An even sadder portrait is a conceptual work. It's by Felix Gonzalez Torres and meant to evoke his lover, Ross Laycock, who died of complications from AIDS. Curator David C. Ward.
It's 175 pounds of candy, which was Ross's weight when he was healthy. And you, the visitor, and I'm going to ask you to do this, everybody takes one candy away.
It's a melon.
Gradually, over time, the weight dwindles from 175 to nothing, and Ross disappears as he did.
A video shows an underground kitschy film from the 1970s, overripe with matadors and Greek gods. The show also includes well-known gay artists, Andy Warhol, Thomas Eakins, Romaine Brooks. The juxtaposition of their work makes it hard to ignore their subtexts, their shades of hiding and exposing.
We have Annie Leibovitz's portrait of Ellen DeGeneres, and DeGeneres is wearing the white face of a mime. She's wearing men's boxer shorts. She's posed in the kind of quintessential Playboy model pose, cupping her breasts.
The tension in so much of this work reflects the tension and the interplay between artists and culture, between gay and straight. The struggle to express the presence of desire makes this, says Ward, a show that's really about everyone. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
And you can see photos from that exhibit on our website, npr.org.
Nora Ephron was born to tell stories. She was raised in Beverly Hills, the daughter of New York playwrights who'd moved west to write screenplays. Screenplays for the likes of Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy. As an adult, Nora Ephron worked as a journalist, and then, of course, she made her own name in the movies, writing When Harry Met Sally and directing her scripts like Sleepless in Seattle. More recently, the 69-year-old Ephron, and we're saying her name because it matters here, has been sharing reflections on aging. First in her book, I Feel Bad About My Neck, and now in a new collection called I Remember Nothing. In it, Nora Ephron spins stories on a mix of subjects, surviving divorce, egg white omelets, and most especially, memory loss. Here, she reads from the book's opening lines.
I have been forgetting things for years, at least since I was in my 30s. I know this because I wrote something about it at the time. I have proof. Of course, I can't remember exactly where I wrote about it or when, but I could probably hunt it up if I had to.
But there's a strategy you've adopted, you write, that I quite admire, which is that you have a whole other list of things you're simply refusing to know anything about so that you don't really have to even remember them in the first place.
Well, I think when you get older, things come along that you know are a test in some way of your ability to stay with it, right? And when email came along, I was just going to fall in love with it, and I did. I can't believe it now. It's like one of those ex-husbands that you think, what was I thinking at the time? Anyway, the point is that you can kind of keep up for a while, and then suddenly something comes along and you think, I give up. I am never going to tweet. I'm just never going to.
Read the list of the things that you're refusing to know anything about at this point.
The former Soviet republics, the Kardashians, Twitter, All Housewives, Survivors, American Idols, and Bachelors, Karzai's brother, soccer, Monkfish, Jay-Z, every drink invented since the Cosmopolitan, especially the drink made with crushed mint leaves. You know the one.
And when I read this, I was like, I know it, but I don't know the name of it.
Yes, we're saved somewhat by Google because you can, when you are all sitting around the table desperately snapping your fingers in the hopes of remembering the name of that movie that you can't remember the name of, you can make people think that you are not as old as you actually are because you have the technology to find the answer.
And you, on that drink with the crushed mint leaves.
Yes,
a quick Google.
The mojito.
Exactly. One of your chapters is about flops. Now, it would seem that you haven't had any flops to the average person who knows about your
yes.
work, but you have right. had flops.
Sure.
You write that flops stay with you in the way that successes never do. How so?
Well, I think that, and I think this is true, by the way, not just of the kind of flops that I'm writing about, but you know, romantic failures, the ends of friendships, these things take up space in your head because it is so possible to lie awake thinking, what should I have done differently? This is one of the reasons why Ambien is one of the greatest inventions known to man, because at least it stops you thinking about that stuff.
Would you read for us at the very end of this chapter on flops?
Yes, happy to read this.
Okay.
Oh, yes, I believe every word of this. Okay. By the way, There are people who have positive things to say about flops. They write books about success through failure and the power of failure. Failure, they say, is a growth experience. You learn from failure. I wish that were true. It seems to me that the main thing you learn from a failure is that it's entirely possible you will have another failure.
But your religion, you say, is get over it.
Yes, absolutely. My religion is get over it, and I was raised in that religion. That was the religion of my home. My mother saying, everything is copy, everything is material, someday you will think this is funny. My parents never said, oh, you poor thing. It was work through it, get to the other side, turn it into something, and it worked with me.
How do you make that sadness, even though it stays with you, also quite funny?
Well, I don't know. If you have parents who are not interested remotely in anything but a funny story, you kind of grow up thinking, can I find a way to... And, you know, I think in some way my mother was teaching me a very fundamental lesson of humor, which is if you slip on a banana peel, people laugh at you. But if you tell people you slipped on a banana peel, it's your joke. And you're the hero of the joke because you're telling the story. So I think that it was a great lesson.
You know, though, for all the wit and the jokes that you have about getting old, the last chapter is titled The O Word, old, obviously. And it, in fact, has an elegiac quality, a wistful quality. It suggests quite a clear vision of loss.
Well, I think that, you know, we've all gotten to the point where we work out and we dye our hair and we don't look as old as we are. But you do get to a certain point in life where you have to realistically, I think, understand that the days are getting shorter. And you can't put things off thinking you'll get to them someday. If you really want to do them, you better do them. There's simply too many people getting sick, and sooner or later you will. So I'm very much a believer in knowing what it is that you love doing so that you can do a great deal of it. You know, when my close friend died, you know, we always sit around and play the game, what would your last meal be? You know, and it's like this fun game where you go around the table and everybody says what it would be. Mine happens to be a Nate and Al's hot dog. I mention this to you because you are in California and you could go get one right now. But Judy was dying of throat cancer. And she said, I can't even have my last meal. And that's what you have to know, is if you're serious about it, have it now. Have it tonight. Have it all the time so that when you're lying on your deathbed, you're not thinking, oh, I should have had more Nate and Al's hot dogs.
Nora Ephron, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much. This was fun.
Nora Ephron's new book is called I Remember Nothing and Other Reflections. And you can read an excerpt at our website, npr.org.
We're going to hear about a film that last year made critics' 10 best lists, but did not make it into theaters. Now, Guy and Madeline on a Park Bench is finally getting released. The critics called it a fresh blend of 1930s Hollywood musicals and the French New Wave of the 1960s. The movie was shot in black and white. Its director is just 25 years old, and Pat Dowell has our story.
Damien Chazelle was a Harvard film student who quit to turn a class project into a feature-length musical. He says he wanted literally to combine documentary-style filmmaking with the classic musicals he spent hours watching at the Harvard Film Archive.
The things about musicals that I liked the most had to do with the sense of spontaneity and the sense of, even though it's a very artificial genre, trying to root it in real life somehow, trying to kind of take these fantastical numbers out of very mundane, everyday things.
Like, say, a girl named Madeline walking in a park and thinking of a boy who's dumped her.
It happened at dawn. Happened in this park. A guy and girl had dallied till the moon was gone.
The idea for me was to really kind of use what I had around me, use Boston, use musicians who lived in Boston, not actors playing musicians, but actual musicians and their actual day-to-day lives, used that as a kind of springboard for a full-fledged musical.
So his main character, Guy, he'd be the boy who dumped the girl, is a trumpet player, played by Boston trumpet player Jason Palmer. He says Chazelle didn't give him a script, only a character sketch.
See, now that's what I'm talking about. Just turn that stereos up.
Then filmed him on the fly.
It's like you never hear anybody blasting Coltrane. You know, or some Charlie Parker or some Billie Holiday or some Bach cantatas or like a Mahler symphony. You know, it's always...
Oh, yeah, that was totally improvisatory.
Jason Palmer.
I was hanging out with a friend of mine. We were in front of my apartment, and we were just talking. And he said, okay, I'm just going to shoot you guys hang out, and we'll just see what we can get. And a lot of the movie was like that. There was no script in that regard. So whatever was said was pretty much off the cuff.
The unforced, matter-of-fact style of the movie is just one of the things that inspired critic Amy Taubin to write in film comment that Guy and Madeline on a Park Bench was the best undistributed film of 2009. In Art Forum, she called it one of the year's best, period.
These are just people who are not actors, but are very close to what their characters are supposed to be. Desiree Garcia, who plays Madeline, is a film professor who, interestingly, did her dissertation on 30s race musicals. There isn't that much dialogue, but their characters are very believable.
She also likes the score by Justin Hurwitz, played by a 90-piece orchestra, and what she calls an absolutely brilliant set piece that takes place in two small rehearsal rooms. An after-hours party turns into a jam session with singers, tap dancers, and a jazz combo in one room, and the trumpeter next door answering phrase for phrase. Taubin says the camera seems like a character stuck at first in the hallway as it tries to catch the action in both rooms.
The way it moves, the way it pans from door opening to door opening, sets the rhythm for the scene in a way that I just found altogether remarkable.
Director Damien Chazelle, who's also cameraman and editor and lyricist, combined the chaos with careful planning. He invited friends to the party and plied the crowd with pizza and drink. The dancers and musicians, on the other hand, were rehearsed for months, he says. Then he filmed the scene over and over, each time in one long shot.
6 or 7 takes all the way through, and I think the one you see is the last take, precisely because, you know, as the musicians would get more and more comfortable and more into their groove, the crowd around them would get drunker and drunker and drunker. So by the end, you have a scene where I think the musicians all know exactly what they're doing, but the crowd has almost forgotten that there's a camera and they're just, you know, having a good time.
As clearly was the director, who finds in the musical a microcosm of the profession he's chosen.
The thing that musicals are about, this idea of, you know, can we create a number, can we break into song, can we put on a show, are the same things that filmmakers ask when they start a movie. It's about creativity, it's about expression. And I think it's something that has always made the genre feel very vital.
Guy and Madeline on a Park Bench survived 2 years in production. It screened at film festivals for more than a year. And now it's opened in New York, just in time for a new set of 10 best lists of films that have made it to a theater. For NPR News, this is Pat Dowell.
On this Veterans Day, we're going to look back, listen back, really, to the war in Vietnam. Its history has been told countless times in books, movies, and plays. Now a new CD collection explores the conflict and its impact through the music it inspired. From member station WCPN, David C. Barnett reports.
In 1969, Gary Hall was an orthopedic technician in the 17th Field Hospital in An Khe in Vietnam's Central Highlands. He saw what seemed to be an endless stream of wounded and dead, and Hall says music took him away, at least temporarily.
In An Khe, I think the popular song was love one another, the young bloods.
Youth is but a song we sing. Fears we will die.
Come on, people now, smile on each other. Everybody get together, gonna love one another right now.
Come on, people now, smile on your brother. Everybody get together, try to love one another right now.
That's the one I remember really strongly.
But if you ask a lot of veterans, the song that captures their feelings about Vietnam is a 1960s pop hit by The Animals, which was really about young people trapped in a British urban slum.
We gotta get out of this place. If it's the last thing we ever do, we gotta get out of this place. Girl, there's a better life for me and you.
There are over 300 songs on the new 13-CD box set titled Next Stop is Vietnam. They range from a folk ballad released just before U.S. troops landed to a 2008 song about the after effects that veterans still suffer. Hugo Kiesing put the collection together. It's a project he's worked on since the early 1970s when he taught psychology courses to U.S. troops a few hundred miles up the coast from Saigon.
By, I want to say, about the mid-1980s, I had collected about 500 45s that dealt with the Vietnam War.
The first Vietnam War protest song to become a commercial hit was a 3.5-minute rant.
The Eastern world, it is exploding, violence flaring. Bullets loading, you're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war, but what's that gun you're toting?
Barry McGuire's Eve of Destruction was banned by many radio stations and the entire Armed Forces network.
The perceived or assumed impact was such that within several weeks there was already the first answer record, the Dawn of Correction, where a very clean-cut group of young men who included members of Danning the Juniors, decided that it was important to refute, point by point, some of the concerns and claims made in Eve of Destruction.
The Western world has a common dedication to keep free people from red domination. Maybe you can't vote, boy, but man your battle stations, or there'll be no need for voting in future generations.
Perhaps the first song to explicitly support the growing military effort in Vietnam was co-written by an Army soldier who recorded this demo version in a Saigon safe house in the mid-1960s.
Silver leaf upon the chest is the men America's best.
Staff Sergeant Barry Sadler was a member of the Army's Elite Special Forces Unit, identified by their green berets, when his commercial recording of the song went to the top of the charts.
Trained to live off nature's land. Trained in combat, hand to hand.
We always admired those guys because they went way up in the hills and in the valleys and did some hell of a stuff. And in our hearts, even though we weren't that courageous to be Green Beret, and when we hear that song, we'd all want to be like Green Beret, you know.
Art McCoy says the members of his platoon were impressed when they first heard the song. But when McCoy got back home to Cleveland, another Vietnam song caught his ear. It was by a local singer named Charles Hatcher, better known as Edwin Starr.
The fact of the matter is that we went with nothing, we lost our lives, and we came back. We really had nothing. If you ask me, that was one of the great battle cries. I think it's relevant right today.
A number of soldiers recorded their own songs while serving in country, and an entire disc on the new set is devoted to them, including this take on the daily news briefings conducted by the U.S. government press office in Saigon, recorded by, perhaps for good reason, an unidentified military staffer.
Mine eyes have seen the story of the winning of the war. It is published every afternoon, a little after four. They put it in the briefing sheets, and then they tell us more, and the truth goes sliding by.
One of the best-known songs of the era is another darkly humorous ditty by Country Joe and the Fish about soldiers marching off to war.
And it's one, two, three, what are we fighting?
by the early 70s, as troops were arriving in Vietnam, they were singing the Feel Like I'm Fixing to Die rag.
Hugo Kiesing.
It was an indication of how divided not only the nation was, but there was almost a gallows humor in singing Whoopee, I'm Gonna Die, as American troops are coming to Vietnam for the first time.
Well, ain't no time to wonder why. Whoopee, you all gonna die.
Country Joe McDonald's performance at the 1969 Woodstock Festival made him famous, but in a 1996 talk at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, the Navy veteran expressed conflicted feelings about the legacy of his signature song.
When I sing Fixing to Die Rag for Vietnam veterans, I know what they're feeling and what they're thinking, but when I sing it to a regular audience, I don't know what the hell they're thinking.
Don't ask me, I don't give a damn, the next stop is Vietnam. Yeah, great song.
Former Ohio legislator John Begala was a sophomore at Kent State University in 1970 when four students were killed by National Guard troops called in to quell an anti-war protest. 1 week later, a new song by Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young came on the radio.
Tin soldiers and Nixon.
To this day, I listen to that song and I get pissed off. It tugs on your emotions and it tugs on your anger, tugs on your disappointment. And the rage, my God, it takes you right back.
For NPR News, I'm David C. Barnett in Cleveland.
Singer Chavela Vargas has the kind of voice that doesn't merely interpret songs. She's 91, and you can tell she's lived every moment of heartache and hard drinking that she's singing about. For our series 50 Great Voices, NPR's Felix Contreras tells us about her life, her loves, and her ageless voice.
She was born in Costa Rica, but Chavela Vargas has the kind of voice that was tailor-made for singing Mexican rancheras, boleros, and corridos.
Ojalá que te vaya bonito. Ojalá que se acaben tus penas. Que te digan que yo ya no existo. Que conozcas personas más buenas.
These lyrics say, I hope that when you leave me, your life turns out well. I hope you meet others who are better than I am. These songs are like mini operas with over-the-top expressions of tragedy, heartbreak, and redemption. And for many Mexicans, Chavela Vargas's versions of these songs are definitive.
Que se llenen de sangre tus venas y la vida te vista de suerte.
Vargas says she didn't start singing until the early 1950s, when she was well into her 30s.
Yo me dediqué a cantar boleros,
I have dedicated myself to sing boleros, rancheras, corridos, all kinds of styles.
At that time, Mexico was in the midst of an artistic explosion, particularly in film and music. Mexico City nightlife was overflowing with nightclubs, dancing, and drinking. Life was un gran festejón, a big nonstop party. And Chavela Vargas joined the party on stage and off with corridos like El Último Trago, The Last Drink. The lyrics say, drink this bottle with me. Let's not stop until the last drink.
Tómate esta botella conmigo. En el último trago.
The lyrics go on to say, let's hope no one sees us together in case you're embarrassed, reflecting another part of her life that played out in song. She challenged mainstream Mexican morals by dressing as a man, smoking cigars, carrying and shooting pistols. She caused sensations with her very public liaisons with women, including a brief affair with painter Frida Kahlo. And she purposely did not change the gender in songs written by Mexico's most famous male songwriters.
Ponme la mano aquí, Macorina.
What made her famous was Macorina. And
I don't think there could be a more queer song for a woman to sing.
Marvit Perez is the curator of Latin American culture and music for the Smithsonian Museum of American History.
And it says, Ponme la mano aquí, Macorina. So it's very suggestive.
Which means?
Put your hand right here, Macorina. And whenever she sang this song, she put such sexuality, desire, and kind of sensuality into it that you knew why she was singing it, how she was singing it, and to whom she was singing it. Definitely, she was singing it to a woman.
Después el amanecer que de mis brazos te lleva y yo sin saber qué hacer de aquel olor a mujer.
Eventually, the drinking, the smoking, and the womanizing took its toll.
En esa época de borrachera,
back then, when I was drinking, the drinking affected my throat. The drinking affected my life, everything.
El alcohol es lo más malo del mundo.
The alcohol is one of the most evil things in the world. So is the cigarette. And I let all of that go from my life, from my art.
In 1979, she retired from the stage and public life. She tells the story of being on the streets in an alcoholic stupor when she was taken in by a poor family who didn't know who she was. They nursed her back to health and clarity. The 1990s saw a healthier and more determined Chavela Vargas return to the stage. She was back in cabarets and giving concerts. Spanish film director Pedro Almodóvar used her and her music in his films. And in a fantasy sequence in the 2002 Frida Kahlo biopic starring Selma Hayek, Vargas shared a drink and a song with her former lover.
Yo soy como el chile verde llorona, picante, pero sabroso. Yo soy como el chile verde llorona, picante.
Looking back, Vargas says it wasn't easy to be lesbian in Mexico in the 1950s and 60s. But as she describes how she got through it all, her words sound very much like the intensely emotional lyrics of the corridos, rancheras, and boleros that she loves to sing.
Yo tenía que luchar contra todo, contra corriente, como dicen.
I had to fight against so many things. Fight against the current, as they say. I have to fight all of them to make something of myself, to triumph.
Pero a la buena.
At age 91, Chavela Vargas is still looking to the future. She says her next project is to put her voice to another dramatic song form, an album of Argentine tangos. Felix Contreras, NPR News.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to NPR's Arts Channel at npr.org/culturetopia. I am Neda Ulibi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.